And our text is Job 38 and 39. Saving Private Ryan is one of my favorite World War II movies for a variety of reasons. But one of those is the way it portrays the average soldier on the ground, the way he feels about the war. Captain Miller and his squad are charged with finding one soldier in the chaos of fighting just days after the D-Day invasion in western France, when troops are scattered far and wide over the landscape. Private Ryan, he's a metaphor really for the whole country in this movie, but Private Ryan is one of four brothers drafted into the war, three of which have already given their lives in battle. A command decision has been made from the top by General Marshall to spare Mrs. Ryan the added grief of losing all of her sons in the war by retrieving her last and youngest son from the battlefield before he too dies. Makes sense, right? To every command officer in the room, yes, this mission makes sense. But to the grunts on the ground who have to carry out these orders, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to Captain Miller, who gets the order to assemble a squad and save Private Ryan. How are we going to find one private in all of this mess? He asks Lieutenant Colonel Anderson, who gives him the order. It doesn't make any sense to the men in the squad, who have to go find Private Ryan amidst the confusion that characterized the first few days of the invasion, when troops were parachuted and dropped far from their initial targets. One of the men says, "You want to explain the math of this to me?" as they're marching. He says, "I mean, where's the sense of risking the lives of the eight of us to save one guy?" It didn't make any sense. In fact, the squad does lose two men before they ever find Ryan. "Think of Ryan's mother," one of the guys says. "What, we don't have mothers? We all got mothers, don't we?" When they finally do find Ryan, when this is explained to him, who is incredulous that this is even happening, he plops down on the ground and he exclaims, "It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense, sir. Why? Why do I deserve to go? Why not any of these guys? They all fought just as hard as me." Especially in war, a lot of things just don't make sense, do they? Especially to the guys on the ground who have to carry out the orders to complete the mission. They inhabit the deep, dark tunnel of chaos where in the moment of mud, blood, and mayhem of the mission, only the narrow picture of the moment can be seen, as vivid and as real as that may be. Same for Job. But the thing is, they don't have the larger picture. The men at the top, like Generals Marshall and Eisenhower, did have the larger picture in mind, and they had a plan and a purpose for each mission, all towards a goal, victory in Europe. I get the distinct sense from Job that he would have been right at home in Captain Miller's squad. For him, his experience at the hand of God doesn't make any sense. "It didn't make any sense, sir," he could say right along with Private Ryan. Yet God himself is about to bring a few things into perspective for Job. The great commander-in-chief of the War of Redemption has arrived. We saw this last week. There is a larger picture, a grander strategy that the Private Ryans in this war of redemption do not always see. That's us. Even when we presume the right to know, as Job has. So let's drop in on this scene and hear what the commander-in-chief in the War of Redemption has to say, shall we? Chapter 38, verses 1 to 38. We have then our title, Inscrutable. A one-word title, Inscrutable. Vast, sovereign, and potent, My will and ways are inscrutable to you, O creature, since the creation of the physical universe. The commander-in-chief has arrived. And he says in summary, vast, sovereign, and potent, my will and ways are inscrutable to you, O creature, since the creation of the physical universe. If you were here last week, you remember the drama of God's approach. You could hear it in Elihu's voice. At this also my heart trembles, Elihu says in conclusion, and leaps out of its place. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. That is, he's approaching. The ground is trembling. Thunder, lightning. Under the whole heaven he lets it go, and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it, his voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. And this is that God who is now before Job. It is high drama, seldom equaled in Scripture, except maybe in Genesis at the creation, which we took our leisure to read this morning, right? Or Exodus when God comes down on Mount Sinai. And then in Revelation when he comes to judge the earth. This is equal drama to all of these texts. Note also the poignant contrast to this Sturm und Drang when a glorious silence obtains at his arrival. And now no one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. Out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty, the Almighty. We cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness he will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. And that's how it concludes, right? Elihu's speeches. Both we and Job are meant to be in stunned silence at this point in the patriarchal lawsuit. Note in your outline that we are at point H. Stuart has provided us then with an outline. We are at point H in that outline. The verdict and the appeal. The verdict with appeal. In every patriarchal lawsuit, the judge or the judges could bring a summary judgment based upon whether they felt enough evidence and testimony had been entered into the record. Point G has been the fulsome and exhausting, literally patient even more than the Senate with Judge Kavanaugh, without question the longest section in the book, right? Point G. But God's arrival upon the scene indicates that indeed the taking of additional evidence is exhaustive. Now closed. The great judge of all the earth is prepared to render his verdict. These are the subsequent chapters. And along the way, Job will make his feeble appeal. So all mouths are now shut. Job, his three friends, and Elihu. Observe as well that God himself has at this juncture stepped down from his bench on high to become a participant in the lawsuit as its judge. Now prepared to render a verdict. This has always been our larger scene, hasn't it? With God, the sons of God, looking over the battlements of heaven, seeing what is transpiring. Well, now God has stepped down from that bench to become a living participant in the lawsuit. We've had this session of the sons of God, a heavenly gallery, sitting in judgment of the accusation of the adversary, Satan, that Job is not a man blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Rather, Job is, as Satan puts it, one who does not fear God for naught, but rather for what he gets, for being righteous, right? That is, Job gets a blessing in a kind of quid pro quo relationship. That is, I obey and you bless, wink, wink, right? That's Satan's accusation. The bulk of Job has been a refutation of Satan's thesis. Job does love, obey, and place his faith in God, irrespective of how God treats him, having treated him as if he were an accursed sinner. God has. But Job fears him because he is God, and Job knows him as well. This we have seen. It's been Job's persistent refrain. And if this all there was to Job, then we might agree with those commentators who assert that Job is a patriarchal Christophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of the Lord. But Elihu in particular intervenes to rebuke Job for his sin of overreach. That is, identifying his sin of calling God unjust in his treatment of himself, right? And in this, Elihu is like the prophets who will follow him. Like Abimelech calling Abraham for his sin regarding Sarah, Nathan calling David on his sin with Bathsheba, or our Lord himself calling Peter for his sin of denial. So, Elihu has prepared us for this moment, and now it is here. What does God have to say for himself? Let's begin with our text, chapter 38, verses 1 to 3. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me." First, observe the grace implicit in the opening. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Job's persistent desire has been for an audience with God. You didn't know what you were in for, did you, Job? Job wants an accounting for what's been happening, an explanation for his suffering. But as all have confessed, none is owed Job, per se, is it? None is owed Job. No explanation is owed Job, per se. Elihu has just admitted, teach us what we should say to him, right? He's coming. All right, Job, what are we going to say to him? We cannot draw up our case because of darkness, as the supernatural darkness surrounds them. Shall it be told him that I would speak? Did man ever wish that he would be swallowed up? Yeah, me, right? Rocks, mountains, fall on us. Hide us from the wrath and the presence of God. The mere fact that God is here to answer is a gift of grace to Job. Intrinsically, he's owed nothing. Nevertheless, God answered Job out of the whirlwind. That is the storm that's kicked up whenever he manifests himself in the created order. Generally, you don't want to be around when God manifests himself in this manner. And the theme is established then for Job's audience too, for his audience with God. Who is this? As if we don't know. That darkens counsel by words without knowledge. It's been echoed by Elihu, hasn't it? The counsel here is judgment. Now, we have drawn distinction last week. We drew a distinction in the sense of judgment in Job. The counsel here is judgment as we have described it. That is God's wisdom and providence. There have been two senses to judgment in Job. Verdict and value, simply put. Verdict and value. That is, I judge you to be a wicked man. I judge you to be a righteous man. There's that sense of judgment. But there's also judgment in terms of value. That is, wisdom in bringing to pass his will and ways in creation. God brings all things to pass and knits them together in the great tapestry of redemptive history. Job being but one small strand in that tapestry. Of the remainder of that tapestry, Job is ignorant, that is, without knowledge. That's the sense of judgment we're dealing with here as well. Wisdom in bringing to pass his will and ways in all of creation. Then Yahweh challenges Job to the ancient contest of wrestling, which we have from the earliest days in all times and in all cultures. I like the King James translation, gird up your loins like a man. That is, gather up your tunic and tie it around your waist with a belt so it doesn't get in the way. And if I get to that belt, I'm going to loosen it so that your tunic falls all around your ankles and you trip and lose the battle. That's the sense of gird up your loins like a man. Or as Paul says in Ephesians, stand therefore having fastened on the belt of truth, the same image. Get ready for battle because it's coming. The way Debbie likes to put on, the way Debbie likes to express it the other day, she said, put on your big boy pants, Job. And that's perhaps the sense in which she, or in which God is challenging Job here. But it is a figure of speech for the real contest, which is that of wisdom. A contest of wisdom, a cutting contest of wisdom. I will question you and you make it known to me. A contest of wisdom where questions were posed and answers were given in a give-and-take fashion until the victor was declared. We've seen this with Job. That is precisely how Job shut the mouths of his three friends, did he not? In a contest of wisdom. Well, I'm here now, Job. And so God begins the contest. Verses 4 to 30, chapter 38. Verses 4 to 30. Read with me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garments and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? And caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the paths to its home? You know. Well, you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth? And who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. I just loved reading this text over and over again all week. Boy, this has been a beautiful, fun, vision-creating sermon to prepare. Some of the most eloquent Hebrew poetry in all of literature, really. This really is a climax of the book of Job. God ushers Job back into the furthest recesses of the dawn of creation to test his wisdom. And having set in motion the great elements which would bring about God's great glory in redemptive history. You can sense in the text dripping with sovereign sarcasm, right? This text drips with sovereign sarcasm. God poses a series of rhetorical questions. Rhetorical questions very effective in immediately tripping the mind to answer, right? That's the effective nature of rhetorical questions. Trips the mind immediately to come to an answer. So with sovereign sarcasm, God poses these questions to which Job is stunned into silence at every one. And we are intended to be as well. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Once again, the idea of understanding is the wise judgment in providence to launch the creative enterprise of redemptive history. Do you have that understanding? Who determined the measurements? Who stretched the line? Who laid the cornerstone? Every structure has a plan, doesn't it? An architect. Are you him? He asked Job in verse 7 if he was among the host of heaven. Now, you're looking at your text, right? You're listening to me, but you're looking at your text. And he asked Job in verse 7 if he was among the host of heaven where this whole lawsuit was initiated, right? Even now, the host of heaven, the myriad and myriad of creatures, the sons of God, looking down from the battlements of heaven, if you will, witnessing the proceedings unfolding with Job himself. Were you among them when they psalmed God's praise in glory for all of his work of creation? Imagine that song. Revelation, we have the new song that is sung at the opening of the will of God, the seal, seven sealed document. What a beautiful text here. These sons of God psalming God's praise and glory at his work of creation. And also note for future reference as we take up then the book of Revelation in days to come, stars are metaphors for angelic beings here in Hebrew parallelism. Do you note that? God then catalogs the remaining realms of creation in this text here, challenging Job in sovereign, sarcastic fashion with repeated rhetorical questions if he possesses the requisite wisdom to guide the course of redemptive history. Who shut in the sea with doors? We begin to see metaphors now for good and evil, for chaos and order. The sea being indeed a picture of chaos as it climbs on the earth. And God says, no farther. You will not create chaos any longer. I like water. I like water in a glass. I don't particularly like going out on big lakes or sea. I like to see the other shore. I like my water in rivers. I don't like big chaotic seas. I get that existential fear when I'm out on the sea, when I'm out on a great body of water, because it could break under the chaos and overwhelm me and drown me at any moment. That's the sense of the chaos of the sea. We see it in creation where the Spirit of God hovered over and brought order indeed to the tohu vabohu of creation. Did he not? That's the sense here as well. We're going to begin to see more and more metaphors for good and for evil, which, of course, has overwhelmed Job's life. And God is saying, I am master of it all. Who shut in the sea with doors? Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Once again, the motif of good and evil is reprised here. God is the one who will shake out the wicked, right? Beginning to see wicked and good, evil and good. God is the one who will shake out the wicked, like we shake out crumbs from a tablecloth, right? The garment of the dawn. Have you entered the springs of the sea? Where is the way to the dwelling of light? Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain? We have the cycle of seasons here as well. Note the limits to evil and chaos represented by the sea. The wicked shaken from darkness by the dawn. God will indeed shake the wicked out from the darkness into the dawn in his own good time. The idea of the gates of death as well. That's been a popular motif all through Job as well. The idea of Job being on the brink of the grave, the brink of death. Indeed, there is life from death as well, the resurrection, which we saw in chapter 19. All of these motifs beginning to be woven now into God's speech to Job. Are you in sovereign control of these things, Job? God is beginning to place all the motifs of Job and his friends now. He's been weaving them now, treating them in context now, putting them into context. All right, verses 31 to 41, then chapter 38. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season, or can you guide the bear with its children? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can tilt the waterskins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clouds stick fast together? Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their thicket? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food? The Lord then turns to the skies and the heavens, does he not? Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth? What in the world is Maseroth, Pastor? Maseroth, there's a transliteration of the Hebrew here. And it might mean a number of things. This is one of those obscure, ambiguous Hebrew words that scholars have had a hard time pinning down. That's okay. It could mean planets, could mean constellations, or maybe a particular constellation. Maseroth. Now, this is a good illustration, parenthetically, a good illustration of a literal translation of a word or a dynamic equivalent translation. The NIV being a classic dynamic equivalent translation, they translate this Hebrew word as constellations. Obscure and ambiguous as the term is, literal translations like the ESV and the King James both leave the word transliterated as Maseroth. Okay? Just an illustration. Classic. This verse is a classic illustration of a dynamic equivalent translation or a literal translation. Well, God's judgment comes into view here. Two, as he surveys the skies. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? That is the course of providence for all things which I have ordained in my sovereignty. The sun, the moon, and the stars were given for times and seasons, were they not? All of which God has in his sovereign control, including your times and seasons, Job, including your times and seasons, congregation. He has established their rule on the earth. Not you, Job. Not you, O Job. God then turns to the animate world to see if Job has any wisdom for us. Right? Point two. chapter 38, verses 39 through chapter 39 and verse 30. Let's go ahead and read those. We just read 39 through 41. 39, verse 1. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth? When they crouch, bring forth their offspring and are delivered of their young. Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them. Who has let the wild donkey go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? To whom I have given the arid plain for his home and the salt land for his dwelling place. He scorns the tumult of the city. He hears not the shouts of the driver. He ranges the mountains as his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes? Or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on him because his strength is great, and will you leave to him your labor? Do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaves her eggs on the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying, his paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains, and the shouting. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and spreads his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and stronghold. From there he spies out the prey, his eyes behold it from far away. His young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there he is. Our scope is beginning to narrow and focus on the life of man. But here we have point number two, inscrutable. Inscrutable. Vast, sovereign, and potent. We're beginning to see just how vast, sovereign, and potent God is. My will and ways are inscrutable to you, O creature, since the creation of the animal universe. Chapter divisions were added later because really, beginning from verse 38-39, God catalogs the animal world. God catalogs the animal world to see if Job might perhaps have some sovereign wisdom to bestow on the creator of all things. Sovereign sarcasm. The animal world with which we humans interact so intimately is lovingly, carefully superintended by their creator, not by Job. Job, you going to go out, superintend the lion and the raven? The lion and the raven, predator and scavenger, respectively. God gives prey and carcasses. There's a whole wild world out there, Job, that you're not even aware of. Will you go out and maintain the wild world? The mountain goat, beautiful animals, aren't they? I've had a chance to catch glimpses of mountain goats here from time to time. Reclusive, elusive they are. God serves as midwife to the mountain goat, doesn't he? Not you, Job. How about the wild donkey? Unlike the domesticated ones you had and got fried, right? This wild donkey is free at my hand. I cavort with him. I leap around the mountains with him. My oxen, too, wild and free. They serve me, not you. Or the ostrich, by nature careless of her young. Nevertheless, the ostrich thrives because I watch over their young. Can you? Can you watch over the young and nurture the young of the ostrich? Can you guarantee the survival of the species? Or the horse, fearless and strong, so integral to human culture, I designed this horse not on the drawing boards of General Motors with great horsepower, but rather in the wisdom of my creation, the horse. Or how about the hawk and the eagle? I so sovereignly designed to fly in the skies, it cleans up the detritus of battle. Each of these bear upon the fate and destinies of all mankind, and ultimately of all creation, and thus all of redemptive history. Are you beginning to see the scope now of your suffering, stroke? They may seem on the outer edges of redemption, but not to me. I see to it that all and every component of creation dovetails to my will and purposes, Job. And further, all of these will be redeemed as well. Who is sovereignly superintending all of this towards these ends? Job, you? Job is being stunned into silence, and rightly so. It is God's providential judgment that is wise. It is His scope and purview over all things, every star, every solar system, every element of creation, every pinion and pebble is made and guided by my hand for my ends, Job. And God is beginning to blend in the good and evil, too, that Job has been experiencing, the destinies of men. We see this. And He's going to wind it all up and tie it in a bow that may be a little tight for Job's neck, for our neck, too. But He's doing it. He's bringing it all home to Job's life. This includes you, and it includes your suffering too, Job, and includes ours as well. If you're not a Calvinist, by the time you finish the book of Job, then you just ain't reading Scripture. It may not make sense. Suffering, our own personal suffering, oftentimes does not make sense, does it, in the larger scheme of things? But it does. It does make sense. And we must trust and serve God for naught. That is, not for what we can get, but because He is who He is. And because we love Him, because we trust Him, that He is indeed weaving this tapestry of which we are but small strands. And it all will be redeemed as well, as we will see. So let us then look to that place where we see redemption wonderfully reprised as well in the body and blood of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.